Go ahead.
Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today our discussion centers on brilliant cookbooks.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The word brilliant is much used in my native land of Britain these days. And it wasn't when I was growing up there. But I think it was the young soccer players used to come over and called everything was brilliant.
It was one of those words that didn't quite translate, but I remember one of the soccer players asked me what cute meant, and I couldn't define it.
So it goes both ways. So if you can't divide cute, if you can't define cute, how do you invite, what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
how do you translate brilliant? The answer is you don't, but the first two cookbooks we're going to talk about today are originate in the land across the big pond, and I got the wrong one. No, the first one finds its aegis in Alice Waters' Japanese restaurant
exactly.
in Berkeley, California.
But not exactly
straight on.
Her cookbook is fabulous. I mean, this is one fabulous book.
See, fabulous equals brilliant, but never mind.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Okay. So it's Samin Nosrat.
And the name of the book is Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
Yeah.
And you'll understand what that means in about 30 minutes from now.
As I said, I love this book. We're going to be talking to Samin Nosrat, who has a wonderful story of herself. And it's like I said to her, this book called Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking, is so good, I don't even know if I can do an adequate job of explaining it to you listeners. I mean, you're going to help me with this because...
Sounds good. Of course, it's
a product of a long preparation. Let's put it that way. What is your story?
So my family is from Iran, and my parents came to California in the 1970s, and I was born in 1979, and I grew up eating really delicious Persian food.
I love Persian food, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. And my mom is really an extraordinary cook, so I really was immersed in good cooking from day one, which was really important, but I definitely did not have ambitions of being a chef at all. It was just I really liked to eat. That was really the main thing. And I always say to people, I think that's a really important prerequisite for being a good cook, is you really have to eat, you know, and enjoy eating.
True, right.
And then I moved up to Berkeley to go to college, and I intended to be an English major, and I had plans of going to graduate school to study poetry. So I really was on one path. But, you know, when you come to school, they give you this orientation. And at that time, it was 1997. And one of the things they gave us during orientation week was they said, oh, there's this very famous restaurant in town called Chez Panisse. And I had zero point of reference for what a famous restaurant was, because there just wasn't the same kind of food culture back then 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't grow up going to fine dining restaurants. So it just sort of went in one ear and out the other. And then the next year I fell in love, and my boyfriend was from San Francisco. So we spent a lot of our time eating together and going out to his like childhood favorite restaurants. And he had always wanted to eat at Chez Panisse. So we saved our money for 7 months. We saved $220. And we went...
he wouldn't be able to get in the door with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Things have changed for sure. It was a long time ago. So we saved $220 and we went to this dinner, and it was really amazing. And, you know, like I said, I grew up eating great food, but so the food was delicious, and that was a special part of it. But I think what was really knocked me off my feet was just this feeling of being so cared for. I had never felt like that in a restaurant before. And so it was very inspiring, and the dessert was chocolate souffle. And so when the server brought it, she said, oh, have you ever had souffle before? And I said, no. She said, would you like me to show you how to eat it? And I said, yes, please. And so she said, well, you have to poke a hole in it and pour this raspberry sauce in, and that way every bite gets sauce. So I took a bite, and she said, how is it? And I said, well, it's really good, but I think, you know, what would make it even better is...
That was funny, yeah.
Yeah, I just offered my opinion. And I said, oh, maybe a glass of cold milk, because, you know, like, I had grown up, you know, warm brownie or warm chocolate chip cookie is really good with cold milk.
Yeah.
And so she kind of laughed, and she said, you want milk? And I said, yes. So she brought me milk, and then she also brought us dessert wine, because what I didn't really know at the time was that it's, like, considered very unsophisticated to drink milk after 10 a.m.
Well, it would have been worse if you had asked for a Coca-Cola.
Totally. Oh, yeah. They would have kicked me out. There's a legend, actually, at the restaurant. It's like urban legend that some cook brought a bottle of Coke and was drinking it while he was working. And he got like, Alice saw him and she fired him.
She would do it. I mean, she would certainly do it.
I don't know that ever happened, but it's pretty funny. It's like scared all of us.
Your next move was very bold.
Yeah, so then I wrote I was so inspired by this meal that I wrote a letter, and I really wanted to work at this magical place, and I wrote a letter asking for a job as a busser, and I brought it into the restaurant, and they directed me over to the floor manager's office, and the floor manager, when she came to meet me, she was the souffle lady. So we recognized each other, and I think, you know, in retrospect, that she was probably pretty desperate, because she hired me on the spot and said, can you start tomorrow? So I started the next day, and, you know, it was really, from day one, it was just so enchanting, and the restaurant is so just aesthetically pleasing and, like, really appeals to all the senses, and it was just so enchanting and amazing, and I felt like I was part of something special from the first moment. And at the same time, I was an English major, and I was sort of becoming aware of the fact that I might have to go get, like, a real job and some real skills. And so I all of a sudden have
this.
But
you've always been a writer, which I think is important, because this book is just so amazingly well written.
Oh, thank you so much, Anne.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I just, so I begged them to teach me how to cook, and it took a little bit of persistence for sure, but eventually they started letting me volunteer in the kitchen, and then finally they hired me in the kitchen. So, and that's really where I learned everything.
Yeah, where to start? You had this concept for this book, actually, as a concept of essentials in cooking from the very beginning, from all those years back. But before we get into that, I wanted to bring up another aspect of this book, is the, instead of photographs, you have illustrations by this wonderful artist called Wendy McNaughton. And not only is she extraordinarily talented, but you and she must have clicked personality-wise, idea-wise, to have everything, your concepts made concrete with her illustrations.
Yes, Wendy is really an extraordinary artist. I was a big fan of hers before we ever met. I always say there have been three really powerful letters in my life and in my career, and the first one was to Chez Panisse, and the second one was to Michael Pollan, who became my mentor, and the third one was to Wendy, who I wrote this letter just begging her to illustrate my book, because I was a big fan of her work, and she's very funny, which is something I really treasure.
Yeah, well,
and especially,
yeah, there's humor in the illustrations too.
Yeah, and I really don't, I really try to encourage my students and everyone to take cooking a lot less seriously than I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so, you know what I mean? It's only dinner. You can always order a pizza if you burn this up. It's not that big of a deal, because tomorrow you're going to have to try again, right? So,
yes.
So I really worked, I just knew from the first moment when I saw her stuff that it would be really, it would be very powerful to have these illustrations. And the whole idea behind the book is that if you know how to use these four elements, if you know how to use salt, fat, acid, and heat, you can make anything taste good wherever you are, even if you're in like a rental kitchen or camping or at home or in somebody's really fancy kitchen, wherever you are, that this is enough. And so it's ultimately about teaching you a way to be able to improvise. And I feel like, as much as I love food photography, which is a lot, it's very much about capturing, you know, it's very representational,
right,
and it captures a particular moment, usually a very perfect moment in time. And I wanted to sort of release you from this weight of perfection.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So,
I have a friend who says that she won't have any cookbook that doesn't have pictures in it.
Yeah, and exactly.
Pictures, no less. But, of course, that's the ultimate goal, is to produce that picture.
I know, and that's the thing is so in a way, actually, it made it a little bit harder. It put a little more pressure on me to be more descriptive in my language to get you where you want to go. And also, Wendy is an incredible fine artist, too. So there are some very beautiful representations.
Oh, there are, but I was most impressed by these illustrations of, like, the pullouts.
Yes, and the concepts and the charts.
Yes, the concepts is amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the salting calendar. Mm-hmm. And then it's beautiful on top of all that. It tells you how much in advance to salt. Of your elements, by the way, I have interviewed many, many chefs over the years, and I've heard repeatedly that the most important thing and difficult thing is to teach when teaching someone to cook is teaching about salt.
Yes, it is for sure that you can't get anywhere until you know how to salt right. So that in a lot of ways it's the most important one.
Taste is different though too.
Yes.
So that's a hard concept, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hard. It's definitely hard, and a lot of people, you know, there have been so many things that we've been taught as an American culture, I think a lot of the time incorrectly, about how one individual element is unhealthy. So how salt is unhealthy, or fat, or sugar,
right,
or all
exactly.
these things. And so things get demonized, and they sort of stick with us in our minds. And it's hard to break people of their habits. And certainly there are people who, you know, are only born with one kidney or have high blood pressure. And so if your doctor has told you to avoid salt, absolutely listen to them over me. But I think, you know, if you're eating a lot of sort of takeout food or processed food, any cooking that you do at home will always have less sodium in it, even if you use as much as I tell you, than what you're getting otherwise. So there's a way to sort of get, and a lot of time actually I find that people use enough salt, but they're not using it early enough.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of the time it has to do with when you're adding the salt rather than how much.
And what kind also.
And what kind as well, yes.
So you cover all that. I mean, this is not just a cookbook, it's a cooking course. And I think you were right in saying if people, anybody, could absorb the contents of this book, they would end up as fabulous cooks.
Yeah, that's definitely my goal. You know, and it was a really big sort of aha moment for me. And the way I came to the realization at the restaurant was that, you know, I walked in and I knew nothing about cooking. I knew nothing about food. I didn't know the difference between parsley and cilantro.
Oh,
and
that
so,
wasn't funny. When you taste, even most people don't know that. But why didn't you think to taste it? I thought that was odd.
I don't even know that I could have known the difference by taste. I think I was so uninformed. I just didn't even know. Like they were just sort of words floating around me that, and yeah, but it was pretty funny. I was such a baby, and I would come into the restaurant, and at that point, you know, that was around 2001, and by then the restaurant had been open about 30 years, and so it was really at a very special point in its life where a lot of people had been working there for over 20 years, lot of the cooks were just extraordinary cooks who had these incredible careers and were really some of the best cooks in the world at that point. And so I had this incredible privilege of learning from them and coming in and sitting at the menu meetings, and we'd all come in and the chef would say, oh, today we're going to make, you know, a Provençal meal. So we're going to have this anchovy galette, and we're going to have fish soup, and we're going to have grilled lamb, and he would describe a vision, and then everyone would just get up and go do it. And no one ever asked for a recipe or clarification or what time something should cook for or the temperature. And it was really mind-boggling to me because at the same time they had given me a really long list of cookbooks and told me to go home and study these books at night. So I would go home and read Marcella Hazan and, you know, Jacques Pepin and Paula Wolfert and study these things. And I was reading one thing on the page, which was very specific. And then I would come into work, and there was such looseness, and I couldn't reconcile. And so,
especially Marcella Hazan, she's very particular.
Yes, exactly. And so it was really kind of I always say I had a headache for about 2 years, where I was just trying to make sense of everything, and I didn't really understand how these guys knew how to make everything, and even the ovens were so well worn that the dials, the numbers had worn off the dials, and so there wasn't even a way to know what temperature the oven was. They would just wave their arms near the oven and kind of guess, oh, that's about 400 or that's about 500. And so,
must have been happening.
Yeah, it was really like, it was very intimidating to me.
Yeah,
and so, Yeah, but eventually I started to see these patterns, and I realized, you know, we were always salting our meat for roasting or grilling or braising we did it the day before for the next day. That was something we always did, no matter if we were making Italian food or French food or Greek or Moroccan or Indian flavors. So it was just sort of a standard thing, and the amount of salt I was taught to use in a pot of boiling water, it was extraordinary, and that never changed, no matter what we were making. Mm-hmm. And, you know, same thing with fat. When I worked on the pastry side, we always had to keep the butter cold, yes. And then when I came over to the savory side, they always taught me to preheat the pan and preheat the fat so we could get nice crispy textures on the outside. And I said, okay, there's something here about fat. And every dish, no matter what we were making, we were always tasting it, and we always had a taster right before service. And the most common things that had to be changed were often like a little bit of salt or a little bit of acid, whether it was a squeeze of lemon or a few drops of vinegar, or sometimes just some cheese was enough to add that salt and that acid. So I was like, okay, got to pay attention to acid. And finally, there was heat. And like I said before, there was just this way where they all had this familiarity and this fluidity with using temperature. And I realized over time that they weren't looking at the oven temperature and they weren't looking at the flames of the grill. What they were looking at was how the food was responding to the temperature. And so that was where they got their cue was, is this browning quickly enough? Or is this at a boil and we need to turn it down to a simmer? So once I realized that those four were the common elements to everything that we cooked, I felt like I was like Albert Einstein of the kitchen, and I felt like I had had this incredible light bulb moment. And I went to the chef who was my mentor, his name was Chris Lee, and I said, oh, Chris, like, I figured it out. It's all about salt, fat, acid, heat. Now I know my ways through the kitchen. And he looked at me. He was just so unimpressed, and he said, yeah, we all know that. You know, we've all been using that since day one. And I felt so betrayed because they just had directed me to these cookbooks, and no one had ever really articulated this to me, and it wasn't in any of the books that I was reading. So at that point, I pretty much knew that I wanted to write a book about it. I even got out a notebook and started writing, and I realized I didn't know enough about either writing or cooking. So I just kept doing both, you know, and then 17 years later, here we are. So
now, this is a course in cooking, and it's going to teach you to understand, actually, not a course, but giving you the fundamental understanding of what you're going for. How do you suggest that people use this book?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I felt like I sort of had to deconstruct and rebuild what a cookbook was in order to make it work for this. And so it is absolutely a sort of like my unified theory of good cooking. So what I did was I almost wrote two books. So part one is sort of like a cooking school in a book, and that's the explanation of the four elements. So my hope is that you will just sit down and read them, and, you know, I tried to fill it with lots of stories and lots of whimsy with Wendy's illustrations to really illustrate the points and help make it humorous and fun and accessible. And I work with a lot of writers in my office, and everyone who's written a book had told me one of the things you have to do before your book comes out is sit down and read it out loud to yourself, because that's a great way to catch sentences that maybe are too complicated or just leaps in understanding and stuff. So it was really helpful. That was one of the last things I did. And I remember when I was doing that, I was really upset because I read it really quickly. And I remember I called my friend she's a New York Times bestseller, and I said, oh, Laurel, I'm so upset. You know, my book is such an easy read. And she said, that's not something to be upset about. You want it to be an easy read. And I said, but I want people to know how hard I worked. And she said, don't worry.
How funny. That's funny.
So, yeah, I really tried hard.
First you read through the whole thing.
Yeah, you read through the first thing.
And then what?
And then part two is a little bit more like a traditional cookbook with recipes. But even there, I tried really hard to show you how now the four elements come into play. And so since I spent half of the book giving you this cooking school, I knew I didn't have all of the room of a full cookbook to give you a million recipes. So what I tried to do was create categories of recipes and then show how things are bound together philosophically. So, for example, I have spent a lot of my career making pasta. I lived in Italy for 2 years.
Yeah, I went to the University of Florence, by the way.
Oh, you did? That's so amazing. Yeah. Oh, that's so awesome. Florence.
And then graduate
really
school,
special.
I went to the University of Michigan in art history, which Ruth Reichel did too.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I mean, it goes together. I mean, writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Art, history, cooking, you know, the whole thing.
My best friend is an art historian, so it's, yeah, totally. We really see eye to eye on so many things, so it's really, it's incredible. And art, and actually art history comes into play in the book in a lot, which I can tell you a little bit about how Wendy and I worked together, and she used a lot of incredible art to inspire her in the way that she made a lot of the drawings. But, yeah, my hope is that you'll sort of see that I've done my best to really distill everything to its essence. So even for the pastas, which have really defined my cooking career is pasta making. I felt really sad because I knew I couldn't put like 50 pasta recipes in there. So I sat down and made lists of all the pastas I could think of and all the sauces I could think of and looked for patterns. And I realized there really are just five basic families of sauces. And if you can learn how to make one from each family, then you can start to learn how to sort of improvise and make your way through. And all of a sudden, all of these pastas become available to you. So I sent that list of ideas over to Wendy, and she illustrated it in this beautiful form of this funny chart called the Pasta Nostra, the intermarriage of five great families.
Right.
And so it teaches you how tomato and cheese and meat and vegetable and fish pastas are all related. And then that goes into five recipes that we wrote out and show you how to make sort of a basic mother version for each one and then a few variations. So,
explore each one of these elements in great depth, salt, fat, acid, and heat. Can you give us like one incident in each of those four categories that it's essential for somebody to perceive?
Sure, absolutely. So I think probably one of the most important lessons about salt is to learn how to use salt earlier and all throughout your cooking rather than just at the table. So I grew up, you know, with salt really in the salt shaker.
The salt shaker,
yeah. Yeah, and it was really at the table, and it wasn't something my mom was really adding into cooking. And actually, I remember my brothers and I used to laugh because our aunt who lived with us, she would always add salt at the table. We're like, why are you even doing that? Yeah. We're like, what's salt for? But it really does enhance flavor, and it brings out flavors, and it makes a lot of aroma molecules much more accessible to us to breathe in. And, you know, aroma is such a big part of taste. And so salt is a big part of making flavors bigger. And so if you add salt into, if you like sprinkle, what I do especially for roast chicken is I love salting it the day before or any sort of roast. If I go to the butcher or get some meat at the grocery store, when I bring it home, the first thing I do when I'm putting it away is just salt it, because really, I mean, if you're going to eat it in the next 2 or 3 days, there's no danger of letting it go for too long. I think beyond that, it starts curing and turning into jerky, but, but, you know, most people go to the store once or twice a week, so it's all good. But when you salt meat early, it gives the salt time to really diffuse all throughout the meat so that every single bite of your chicken is seasoned and delicious rather than just having like a nice salty skin and totally bland bite of chicken breast. So that's a big part of it. And then also it actually helps, sort of, it changes the structure of the proteins inside the meat and turns them into almost a gel so that when they cook, so much more moisture is retained in the meat. So when you salt your meat in advance, it actually ends up being much, much moister and more tender when you're eating it. So
yeah, no, really, that's a point that I should make here, is that people who read this book are going to get a good dose of food science in the process.
Yes, I did my best to sort of try and make it as accessible as possible, because I'm not a scientist, and there's so much where I understood it, you know, I understood it through my experience, and I felt like I owed it to the readers to go back and do a little bit of science homework and figure out the why, you know, after all of these years of knowing. And so I kind of followed this crumb trail of science and did my best to do the homework, and then I relied on a bunch of scientists to help me figure out how to talk about it. So,
and it's a good way of approaching fat too, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And so after salt comes fat, which, whereas salt is this incredible enhancer of flavor, fat is actually a really sort of priceless carrier of flavor.
Yes.
And a way I love to illustrate that point is if you take a garlic clove and you simmer it in some water, and then you take another garlic clove and you just sizzle it in a little olive oil, and then if you were to taste that water, it would taste really quite watery and barely garlicky, maybe faintly garlicky, whereas the oil would be really perfumed with those garlic aromas, and it would taste really rich and sort of very, very flavorful. And so there's a way where there are a lot of flavor molecules that are fat soluble and they're not water soluble. So we don't ever get to taste them unless there's some fat in our meal. And so it's a really incredible thing. And also fat itself is really a way that we define the flavors in our cooking. And so this was kind of mind-blowing for me to realize where, you know, butter is the classic French fat, and olive oil is the classic Italian fat.
Right.
And if I were to wanted to make Thai food and I used olive oil, it would never taste right because olive oil would be at the foundation. So what we did was we made these wheels, and we made one for each of fat and acid and for spice combinations that really show the global the traditional fats and acids and spice combinations from around the world.
Yeah, and I should point out that in addition to having studied in Italy, I mean, you're really well-traveled, so you are very familiar with the global cuisine.
Yeah, and I did a lot of homework. You know, that was the other thing, is I sort of have like a crippling curiosity.
Yes, I know that. So, Peter says I over-research everything.
Yeah,
so,
and so
moving on to acid, though, this is something I preach about, is how a splash of acid elevates all the flavors.
Yes, it really makes a big difference. And so whereas salt is the enhancer and fat is the carrier, acid is really the flavor balancer. So a little bit of acid will a lot of times make something that feels a little bit off all of a sudden come to life. And a really big, like, aha moment for me about this was one day at the restaurant at Chez Panisse, I was making a carrot soup, which was so simple. It was just onions and olive oil and carrots and water, you know, so simple. And I seasoned it with salt, and I felt so proud, and we pureed it, and it was this beautiful orange color, and I really felt like I had gotten the seasoning right, and I brought a spoonful to the chef to taste, and he was in a hurry to go upstairs, and he said, oh, yeah, tastes fine, like, just add a capful of vinegar and then bring it upstairs for me. And I just thought he was crazy. I was like, why would you add vinegar to this carrot soup? It's so sweet and perfect. That's going to ruin it. And so, you know, I took a little spoonful and I added a drop of vinegar because I didn't trust him. I was like, he's crazy. And so I did it. And it really, what it did was it balanced that sweetness. It balanced the saltiness. And it was really sort of offering a dimension for everything else to bounce off of. And that's something I've learned, is a lot of times you just need just enough acid so that you can't even taste it.
Right.
But what it does is it heightens everything else, and it really balances it.
It also changes the mouthfeel, which I think is important, too.
Yes, exactly.
So heat is your last one here.
Yeah.
And I was surprised you said never expose food to direct heat. I mean, like, don't
over
ever
the
put
grill?
It over the, oh, yeah. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, so that was a big thing I learned in the restaurant was, you know, in my mind, when you watch sort of like guys grilling on TV, you're always seeing them, and they put the thing over the flame, and the flame flares up, and it looks so dramatic on the Burger King commercial or whatever. Actually, that the moment when the flame touches your food, these weird molecules are formed that don't taste good. They taste almost like
bitter
propane gas. Yeah, and you often get like these weird black burnt splotches and stuff, and so that's not what you want at all. And in fact, the flame isn't necessarily even the hottest part of a fire. It really is those of really hot coals is what you want to be cooking over. So whether or not you're cooking something over direct heat or indirect heat, you never want to cook over flame, because that's not going to make your food taste good. And so that was a big moment for me to realize, and I really learned it by watching Alice herself cook, grill, which she really is sort of like she has a preternatural ability for grilling. And what she does is she's just constantly, you know, once the meat starts browning, she just keeps moving it, because what I learned from her was that those grill marks that are always on the, like, on the TV commercials, you know, you don't actually want the grill marks, because grill marks mean that all of the other part of the meat that doesn't have grill marks isn't browned, and that browning is flavor. So once meat starts to brown, you move it all around so things can get really evenly browned on all the sides, and more browning is more flavor.
Well, you know, as if that's not enough, your recipes are very exciting, and readers will get recipes for salads, dressings, vegetables, stock and soups, beans, grains, pasta, eggs, fish, chicken. You do a lot with chicken, meat, sauces, butter and flour doughs, sweets. You have a whole section on desserts. It's an indispensable cookbook, is what I say, Simon.
Thank you so much, Anne. Yeah, thank
I
you.
Really, I, you've had good reviews so far, and I wish you much success and continued success with this book, because I just love it.
Thank you so much. It really means a lot to me.
Before she goes. And in case you think On the Menu doesn't pay attention, we're having a ribeye steak for dinner tonight. And you know what I did when I first got it home from the store?
You salted it.
I salted it, both sides, heartily.
Yes, we'll never be the same again after talking to her.
And I'll never do grill marks again. But seriously, folks, after the break, we're gonna continue on the interesting theme of fabulous cookbooks.
Brilliant cookbooks.
Right. One which comes from Lancashire, not too far from where I grew up, and the last place in the world you'd expect to find a brilliant cookbook.
Well, isn't that where they make hot pot?
Lancashire hot pot, yeah. which is about as interesting as a cold shower.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, we have, I think, very timely, I'm thinking, I guess, seasons, book called Around the World in 120 Salads. And I, for one, I don't know about all of you, but I always look for something a little bit different in a salad because it's sort of like it's a side that you can use to perk up the meal. But some of these recipes are actually meals themselves. And we're going to be talking to Katie Caldese, who with her husband, Giancarlo, owns restaurants and writes books. And
they have a cooking school as well.
Cooking school, yeah.
Yeah, they're amazing in that one of their restaurants is in Bray, the home of the Fat Duck and the Waterside Inn and six Michelin stars. And the other one, which is an Italian-themed restaurant, is in a section of the City of London called Marylebone. And we're hoping to see them in a few weeks' time when we will be over there in the big city. In the meantime, of course, we're saddened like all of you are with the tragedy of the terrorist attack and then this fire.
Just happened
not too very far away from places that we're actually going to be. So We'll be thinking of them now. We'll be thinking of them then. In the meantime, however, Giancarlo and?
Well, we're going to be talking to Katie Caldese.
Katie Caldese.
Yes. Reading this book, Around the World in 120 Salads, Katie Caldese refers to herself as a salad girl, opposed to her husband, who is a pasta guy. I have to be with you, Katie. I am a salad girl, too. And it's hard finding salads, recipes that are new and inventive and something I haven't had before. And this book fills all those.
Oh, well, I'm very pleased to hear that. I think America is a fantastic place for salads, actually. So, no, that's praise indeed coming from you.
Well, you actually lead me to the first question, which you start your book, and it is a question. What exactly is a salad?
Well, yes, very interesting that I sort of thought I knew, and everyone imagines just a pile of green leaves, I think, is their sort of instant image of salad. But as I asked more and more people, some people said, oh, it means something that's been chopped. And other people said, it's green leaves, and it must be green. And somebody else said, it must only ever be raw and not cooked. And so I started to sort of Google it, and actually still you get lots of descriptions. But I believe that it comes from the old Latin word salato, or salted. And so they used to have erbe salato, was dressed leaves or salted leaves. So it goes way back to ancient Rome when they used to make a dressing from vinegar and oil and salt.
and pour it over leaves. And so I believe it goes all the way back to then. And so actually it could be cooked, because if you have a lovely cooked vegetables and you toss them in a dressing, that's still a salad.
And you ask also the question, what makes a good salad? And I'm not so sure I agree with you altogether on this, because, I mean, I agree with the balance, but I hate if somebody throws sugar in my salad.
Okay, well, even if it's just a teaspoon.
Yeah, I can't, I mean, a lot of people put sugar.
She's tough. She can smell the sugar.
That's fine.
She's really dangerous.
Sugar out. And actually, my husband was diabetic, and he's now managed to reverse his diabetes, so we're a little bit sugar phobic, if you like. So I don't always put sugar in, but I think sometimes, my mother taught me to make a vinaigrette many, many years ago, and she always put 1 teaspoon of brown sugar in her vinaigrette, and it was beautiful, and actually that served about 8 to 10 people, so it's a minimal amount of sugar that you're having, but it just takes the edge off the sharp vinegar.
See, I drink vinegar, so I'm not a good candidate for putting
sugar. Oh, okay. There are people that really love vinegar. I quite like it, but I like it tempered by something else. But yeah, you're a vinegar girl.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I'm a bitter freak, because as we were talking, I love all the bitter green.
Right, yes, yeah. Well, that's very Italian, actually, isn't it?
Sicilian, particularly, yeah.
Like the bitter taste.
Yeah.
Let's start this story a little bit from the beginning.
Okay.
Because somebody was an artist and somebody was a chef, and I can't remember which it was between you and your husband.
Yeah, I was the artist. He commissioned me to paint a mural in his restaurant.
Which at the time was in Italy?
No, it wasn't. It was in the city of London.
Oh, okay. So he was already here.
Yes.
And so, you know, I mean, we keep running into artists in the food world all the time. I mean, we're going to be interviewing Gail Gand, and she was having an exhibition not too long ago. And there are either artists, studio artists, or they're art historians, all sort of ending up in food. You know, I'm an art historian, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, so I noticed that connection more and more. You actually take this concept of salad much further than basics, though. What I said to you before we came on air is, I love your recipes. I love them.
Oh, good. I'm so pleased.
But you draw on a global larder, do you not?
Yes, I do, yes. Going back to your point earlier about what makes a good salad, I think that I learned such a lot from going to Vietnam. We took ourselves on a family holiday to Vietnam and made salad sort of almost every day that we were there with various different people, trying to really get the gist of what makes a fantastic Southeast Asian salad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that balance comes from, and the mixture of textures. And you should have something chewy in your salad, and you should have something crunchy and something bitter and something slightly sweet. It doesn't have to be sugar. It might be something like a red pepper that gives you sweetness and crunch, or a little bit of apple or something. And when you start thinking of all the great salads that you've had over the years, not always, but a lot of them do tick all those boxes, and you think, yes, of course, that's what makes a great dish or a great salad, is that combination of textures and flavors and getting the balance right.
Well, you know, you do another thing that I am really in admiration of is, so you have your concept of the salads, you have your worldview idea, and then you also, on top, don't you have all, it's all gluten-free for the most part and appropriate for diabetics. Then you take and you break down the recipes, the book, into day parts. Now that's gutsy, Katie. I mean, salad for breakfast, I've taken to eating breakfast bowls where I think that's an idea I picked up from Asia.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you have some really wonderful ideas. I love this green juice thing you made.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, I really liked that. That was from New York. And I thought it wasn't exactly a salad the way I had it in New York, but I thought, well, that's a great basis for a salad, to make a juice like you would have at breakfast time, but use it as a dressing.
Right. And where did it come from in New York?
Estella restaurant.
Oh, right, Estella. I think I read that. Estella's,
which I loved. I love that place.
Yes. But then you go on, you have regular appetizers, main course salads. You do actually even a dessert salad, which is really gutsy. Tell us about that.
Well, I suppose we've all heard of fruit salad, haven't we? But I wanted to show that, you know, salads are something you can have at all times of the day, and to sort of throw collections of fruit and vegetables together and, you know, how versatile it is. So, and look, there's also a little bit of a dried fruit salad as well for winter when there isn't so much fresh fruit around. And then there was an Egyptian salad, the one which is bananas and nuts, and then it has and dates, and then it has a tahini and molasses dressing on it.
I mentioned this once before talking to a guest, is I accidentally discovered we have this really good tahini, and it's kind of, you know, it could be chalky, but it's really good. But I had that.
We don't have any anymore. I finished it yesterday.
Oh, no.
Well, there wasn't very much of it left.
But anyhow, I had it in my mouth, and I sipped some pickle juice, and boy, was that good.
Wow.
I was planning on expanding that, but I guess I have to get more tahini.
You will have to. Well, if you want tahini with your vinegar juice, you'll have to.
Now, what are some of your main course salads that you like particularly?
One that we do at home a lot is the tabbouleh with date-crusted lamb.
Oh, that's also good.
All my family are very happy chomping into a shoulder of lamb that's been slow-roasted with a crust made of dates and butter and spices. And it's something that we all eat, and then you just sort of pull it apart. It sort of falls off the bone after long, slow cooking. And then we have that with tabbouleh and maybe a yogurt with some mint in it. And I like things like that. It's a simple lunch to create. And it's just got all the colours and, again, all the textures that you want, really.
Can you put that on the menu when we come to lunch in a couple of weeks?
I would, but it's not Italian, unfortunately.
Okay. Oh, dear.
You discuss rubbed kale, which is a technique that I find curious.
Well, it's something that I learned to do. I think I probably did see that in the States as well, actually.
You massage your kale.
But it seems to soften the kale up a little bit before eating it. I'm not sure if it actually breaks down the cells slightly. I think I read online that that's what it's doing when you rub the kale. You're just softening it a little bit. And sometimes it can be quite hard to digest too much kale, which I suppose is why people blend it in a smoothie. But if you want to have it raw, it often helps to massage it a little bit first with some oil and salt.
Now, you have a number of items that are charred. You know, that's like the hot new thing. Everybody likes charred everything.
Yeah.
So, you have salads from the sea, but, you know, you don't seem to have any seaweed, which is another hot item.
I've got a little bit of seaweed in the Japanese salad.
Okay.
I saw seaweed in there. Yes,
yeah.
We have
a lifetime supply.
We have a lifetime supply. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, from Maine, real seaweed, you know, big chunks of stuff.
Oh, wow. Well, I suppose, yeah, I mean, I did experiment a lot with more seaweed, but I found it quite difficult to shop for something that was consistent. So if you say, go and get 4 ounces of seaweed, well, that's so different all over the world.
Uh-huh.
But, and then some of them need soaking and for longer than others. It was just extremely complicated. So I have one bit of seaweed in there. But, yeah, I know it's really good for you, and I wanted to use a bit more, but I found it difficult to write in a book that would sell over the world.
Well,
so
you know,
that's my reasoning behind that.
My seaweed order came with a recipe book.
Oh, well, that's handy.
And I have to keep referencing it because every type of seaweed, first of all, some of it has different names, like referring to Japanese names or some other names.
Yes, it does.
And then there's the soaking times are all different, and how you handle it is different. And,
well, that's exactly what I found. I found it really difficult to get consistency. And does yours come in fresh or?
No, it's dried. Cut it with scissors, and you have to reconstitute it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, actually.
Yes, it is a lot of work. Mm. And it's not to everyone's taste, although a lot of it is lovely. So I'm afraid, yes, it didn't make a big appearance in the book, but that's not to say I don't like it.
So Peter read more thoroughly than I did. He saw it.
Yeah, I saw it in there, yeah.
Now, it was
a Japanese salad. It had seaweed in it, by definition,
so.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
You have sides. It's not just salads, but you also sort of expand your menu options with sides.
Are they the ones that are on the funny green pages?
No, I don't think so. The sides are in there. Because I wanted people to know that, you know, salad can be a main thing or it can be a side, in which case it should have a fairly subtle dressing so that it can go with something else rather than dominate the rest of the things on the table.
No, I was looking. Anne's looking at the book right now, and I'm looking. What color is that? Is that yellow or green?
It's green. It's chartreuse.
It starts off green. Simple little sides.
Okay, there you go. So that's why it's green.
Yes, yes.
See, I'm colorblind, so I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
Page 153 it starts on.
There you go.
So anyhow, I mean, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't add one thing, is that you really found yourself a fabulous food stylist.
We really did. Susie Theodorou, she is fantastic.
Now, I mean, you said that she taught you about cutting vegetables. I mean, I don't think people think about that much.
Yeah, I know. I didn't. And when she arrived at our house, I was saying, oh, shall I show you how I sort of have been doing this salad? And I showed her a couple of things. And then she said, okay, shall I show you how I think it should be done? And I said, yes, okay. So she showed me, and after that moment, I didn't show her anything ever again. She is so talented, and she lives between London and Manhattan, and is very aware of trends and new ways with vegetables, and we just learned so much from her. So, yes, that's why I had to put in Susie's method of chopping things at the beginning of the book.
Well, I mean, I think everybody should learn a lot, or will learn a lot from this book.
Oh.
Yeah, and let's do the commercial part before we forget. Because
yes.
The book is called, sweetheart, what's it called? It's called
Around the World in 120 Salads.
You can find
subtitled Fresh, Healthy, Delicious.
And you can find that on OTM Bookshelf or on your favorite bookseller across the world.
And the authors are Katie and her husband Giancarlo Caldesi.
And let's not forget they also have a cooking school.
Yes,
and
several restaurants.
And a restaurant in London near to Marylebone Station, and one in the, shall we say, what can we say, the high altar of British cuisine, the little town of Bray.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Where they decided they would compete for 3 stars with the Fat Duck and the Waterside Inn.
That's right, yes.
Well, thank you for talking to us, Katie.
Oh, you're more than welcome. It was lovely to talk to you, and I hope to meet you soon in London.
Yeah, yes, please say ciao to Giancarlo.
Thank you. I will. Thank you.
Ciao, Katie.
Thanks very much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You know, it takes a certain knack, a certain skill to actually teach people how to cook. I mean, it's something that I consider to be overwhelming, but our last guest, and this guest coming up, who's John Waite, they do it with their books, they do it with these schools that they found. They're really amazing people.
And he does it on television, too.
And he does it on TV, and this book is ingenious. It's perfect plates in 5 ingredients. So, I mean, this is, if you want to have some masterpieces with as little effort as possible, just throw together these 5 ingredients he talks about in the book.
He also says, like, he quotes Coco Chanel very cleverly.
Yes.
Who always said, before you go out to the house, take at least one garment off.
And one piece of jewelry or something.
And he believes in dropping at least one ingredient out of the recipe.
Exactly.
And the results, I think, are really rather fascinating and exciting. And
streamlined.
Yeah, there you go.
Streamlined.
And here we go, John.
Well, I think that I was having some trouble with that accent, John Waite, but hopefully our listeners will be accustomed to it.
besides, you have a translator on board.
I have a translator here. So anyhow, John Waite
You are the winner of the Great British Baking Show, which has gotten so much press in the U.S. as well as the world, I guess. And you've written your third cookbook, which is Perfect Plates in 5 Ingredients, subtitled 100 Stunning Yet Simple Recipes. And it's interesting that you've crossed over into the savory realm with this book, for sure, haven't you?
I have, and I think that's always a concern when somebody from a baking show tries to cross over into savory recipes. But actually, if you think about it, as much as we'd like to eat cakes and muffins and pies 3 times a day, if you did, you'd need coronary surgery very, very quickly. So I think, you know, I cook 3 times a day. I eat 3 meals a day. So I am as proficient a cook as I am a baker.
Yeah.
And I think it's a, you know, it's something I've always wanted to do. While I love my baking books, I also really love my this Perfect Plates, because it's not only is it the first savory book I've done, but it was a baptism of fire, because to write a book that's restrictive and pared back is not an easy thing to do. So I think I'd like to, you know, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I love the book, as I told you that. And, I mean, this comes from somebody who always has a rotation of 300 cookbooks sitting, review copies sitting in her hall, you know? So, but anyhow, I really enjoyed it. And I told you I'm going to actually make some of these recipes.
That's unusual.
Thank you.
That's
well, I'm honored then in that case.
Yeah, you should be suitably honored, especially considering that you're a renegade. Now, most listeners will not understand the Wars of the Roses, but you and I both do, and sadly, unfortunately, Peter's side and Richard III finished up on the short end.
I know we shouldn't really be speaking right now, you and I.
We shouldn't.
We should speak only through our thing.
Well, here's what we have to get straight. What we have to get straight is you eat your Yorkshire pudding with the gravy before you have the meat. You don't put it on the plate with everything else and make a great big mess.
No way. It needs to soak up all the meaty juices as well as get tainted by the carrots. You've got to, you Yorkshire guys, you invented it, but we completely improved it. We made it better.
You know the reason why, right?
Go on.
Because Yorkshire people are so mean, they're so cheap. And they need to make sure you don't eat too much meat. So you have your guest body soak up the
carbs,
the Yorkshire pudding, the carbs before the meat comes out.
What do you think about these American popovers then that are rolled in cinnamon sugar? Oh, surely you don't like that.
Listen, my mother later in life sadly picked up the Lancastrian way. I've never understood it. It didn't matter how much we screamed at her, she still did it that way.
With it.
You're supposed to make it in a great big flat pan. It's exactly what you're supposed to do. But she changed her mind and decided to do it the popover way. And I think that's pretty much become universal now.
Yeah,
I think you have. We can forgive that.
So anyhow, you have a nice introduction to your book explaining what you set out to do here, which is this premise and promise.
Yeah. So it's just to make sure that these recipes are simple and basic, have 5 ingredients. But the promise is that they won't be awful or insipid or bland or horrible, because that's not what food's about. Food, in its most basic form, is about preparing very rustic ingredients with a rustic sentiment, which is basically, I think, what Italian cookery is about. It's taking good ingredients and putting them together in the right way without any undue trickery or magic. Although, having said that, there does have to be some trickery in the book, because in Britain, we don't really necessarily have the best ingredients. A lot of the tomatoes and strawberries, for example, are very, very bland. And so we have to find ways of cooking those ingredients to make the most of them. So while it's about the beauty of the ingredients in their own right, it's also about how you can prepare them the best way and the most efficient way to make them taste the best. And so that's it. It's simple, it's straightforward, and it actually makes you a better cook, or a better eater at least, because you appreciate the combination of flavors better. It's very easy to overwhelm somebody's palate and throw thousands of ingredients onto a plate and confuse them into thinking they've had the most delicious thing in the world. But actually, the real skill lies in being able to cook with just five ingredients.
Right.
The interesting thing is, just we just back from 3 weeks in Australia, and we interviewed a whole lot of chefs that were out there, and at least a couple of them said, when we asked them why they became chefs, they said because their mother was the worst cook in the world. Now, the funny part about it is I'm putting my mother up against them. I guess she didn't care.
She didn't like to eat. The only thing she wanted was dessert.
It sounds a bit like my mum, but she's not the best cook, and she makes what we have, it's called a Lancashire hot pot, so it's lamb and potatoes, and she makes it very, very watery and very, very peppery. But you know something, even though it's not very good, it would be my final meal if I were on death row. It would be the thing I would want, because it was, you know,
it was hers.
You see, the funny part about it is my last meal on death row will be at Richard Corrigan's Lindsay House in London. he did something absolutely magical with sweetbreads.
Well, you know, planes can get fridges in them these days. We can send them over to you. We have to. Transatlantic one over for you.
Well, Andy, you have an interesting organization here. You have morning plates, hearty plates, everyday plates, worth the weight plates, which is slow cooking, posh plates, which is my most favorite section, many plates, sweet plates. And you have a little introduction to each one of these sections explaining exactly what you're going to do when you do it. The thing that's genius about your recipes, however, is you will slip in an ingredient that changes the whole basic concept all around. How did you do that?
I guess it was just a case of experimenting. I think you have to go through the process of trying out a combination. How can it be improved? Does it need to be improved? Looking beyond the realms of what I know now of combinations, that is. So looking for inspiration from different chefs, from the internet, from other cookbooks, because ultimately we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, so we have to take inspiration from various different sources. And so for me, it was just a case of eating as much as possible to make informed decisions on what I think works. So it was a very delicious experimentation process, that's for sure.
I like your hummus, pepper, and gorgonzola flatbread pizza.
Oh, that's pure filth.
That looks really good. One thing I noticed is that a fried egg on there? I noticed you make very skillful use of fried eggs in many of your recipes.
Well, if you think about it, a fried egg's a perfect sort of addition to a dish because it's its own sauce, isn't it? The velvet unctuousness of the soft yolk really helps to bring everything together, and you don't need to make a burn egg. You've got a cooked egg yolk, a runny egg yolk. So eggs are important and very often overlooked and underrated, I think. But I didn't just add an egg to bring the thing together willy-nilly. It had to be considered, and it had to have its place. Every single ingredient in the book has been considered with due care and consideration, because it has to be. Otherwise, it could throw off the entire balance of the recipe.
Yeah, and Anne's looking at chorizo and chickpeas.
Braised in cider.
Well, that's delicious.
No, that's simple.
You must make that. It's simple, and it's quite a traditional, you know, chorizo cooked in cider is often found in Madrid tapas bars. But the addition of chorizo and the parsley and the chicken stock, listen, you have to try that. It's delicious. But you must make sure that you use the really plump garbanzo beans, not the rubbish, crappy,
I just had them
in tins.
I had leftover dinner for lunch, and it was Peter had cooked sole with chickpeas.
Oh, lovely!
But they were
freeze dried.
They were freeze dried chickpeas.
Have you tried those?
So they were like Mr. Birdseye's chickpeas.
Wow! No, so they were like they were freeze dried. So they were dry.
They came out of the freezer.
The texture is better than with the canned ones.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. Because you have the by the time the chickpeas thawed, it's like it was just coming off the out of the bunch. I mean, out of the crazy haystack kind of thing that chickpeas grow in.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a chickpea actually growing on a tree? They're the funniest looking things you've ever seen.
Yeah.
I'm going to go straight. I've got my computer here, so I'm going to go straight to Google Images.
And see what they look like.
I'm going to find that. You can probably hear me typing.
The interesting problem with fresh chickpeas, if you get fresh chickpeas, they have a skin on them.
Oh, it's a nuisance.
Underneath the pod that you can't get off. So that's why we buy them freeze dried.
I've tried this.
It's a lot quicker.
I've asked every chef I've interviewed, do you have some sort of trick for how do you get this skin easily out of the fresh chickpeas? And they don't.
They say dishwashers. No. That's what dishwashers do in their spare time.
Just buy them.
Exactly.
Well, it looks like it's almost like a sort of olive grove. It's like the burning bush from the Bible, isn't it?
Yes.
The burning chickpeas.
You got it up already.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got it here. I've already flipped through about 10 images.
Then here's another one that I think is genius. I keep referring to you as genius. I hope you don't mind that, John Waite.
I'll take it. I'll accept it.
Okay. But this one is, I love panzanella anyhow. But you make it with pistachio and artichokes, and you crisp the bread. I mean, it's fabulous looking.
Well, which is the other one?
The pistachio and artichoke is a combination that I actually had in Napa. Yeah. I was in this pizza place, and I ordered a pistachio and artichoke pizza, and then this lady came in, this fabulous lady, and she had these. She had these dogs with her two little lap dogs, and she had these glasses on. And she said to the barman, "Have you got anything that I can crunch on?" And I thought, "Oh my gosh! Imagine if artichokes and pistachios were in a crunchy situation. That would be amazing." And so then I sort of put this idea of this crunchy lady's cravings with the combination, and it came out as my panzanella.
Well, what was the other one you liked? You had one that had sweet Riesling in it.
Oh yeah, where's that one?
That was asparagus and leeks
with sweet Riesling. I'm making that one too.
Yeah, that's a curious combination because the Riesling goes quite.
Asparagus and leeks braised in sweet Riesling and tarragon with prosciutto.
It's gorgeous. The Riesling goes really quite sort of tangy sweet, and then the tarragon lends it sort of. What is it, like an anisey, licorice kind of vibe, and then the prosciutto, the fattiness of it all just brings it all together, and it really is, it's abnormal, but it works so beautifully. That was one of my sort of, I think I was hungover the day I wrote that recipe, and I think that's all I had left in the fridge with those ingredients, so that actually might have been, because we should have called that the serendipity recipe, because it just, like the tart tartan,
came out
of nowhere.
Hold on a minute, I've read your book, and it seems to me you've been hungover on more than one occasion.
I'm 27 years old.
There was something with avocado and something else.
Avocado and butter beans.
That was it. No, I don't think that was it. But anyway, it was a hangover cure, you said, whatever it was.
Oh yeah, it was the avocado and lima beans. You call them lima beans over there, don't you?
We do.
Yeah. So it was that sort of, it was like an avocado hash kind of thing, an avocado skillet.
Right.
And yeah, that was based. Yeah, that was one of the sort of cupboard and fridge foraging recipes as well, fueled entirely by a hangover.
Yeah, we just got back from, we were in Australia covering the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival and the world's 50 best restaurants. And we stayed in Tasmania before all that started with Peter's cousin who grows organic avocados. They're the best things you've ever tasted in your whole life. So we kind of had avocados three times a day.
Well, they're good for you.
Well, I mean, I guess you could overdo anything. And here's something else I'm going to make. Brazil nut and Gruyere pesto. I don't know about the shattered lasagna sheets, but I'm going to make the pesto. I love playing around with different pestos.
Yeah, it's delicious. And actually, I've just finished writing my next book, which is a comfort food book, and I've got a great pesto recipe in there. I'm not going to tell you what it is because everyone will steal the idea, but you'll love it. Maybe I can email it to you.
Yeah, well, you could do that.
Yeah, send it to her, it's a secret.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I'll send it top secret, classified information.
Okay, on the menu at onthemenuradio.com.
Okay, and now, since you're a baking expert, of all these desserts that you list, what is your favorite?
Oh, that's a hard question. That's like asking a mother to pick a favorite child. I think, for me, the favorite dessert in there has to be the sticky toffee upside-down banana cake.
That looked wonderful.
The only thing is, it's a bit of a problem because you have to make it a day in advance for the to enable the sponge to become really tender. Because when you first make it, it's quite dry and you wouldn't enjoy it. But a day later, you wouldn't believe how puddingy and how tender everything becomes. So that's my favorite pudding, my favorite dessert. But you definitely unequivocally have to make it a day in advance and leave it in the cake tin and just forget about it.
Yeah, one that I was not taken with at all, but you have to understand I don't have much of a sweet tooth, is the Nutella pudding with caramelized pretzels.
You're lucky I don't hang up on you right now.
Hold on a minute. One of the taste treats that we had at a rapidly becoming infamous restaurant called Dinner by Heston Blumenthal. Yeah. One of their desserts has Vegemite ice cream.
Yeah, that was really disgusting.
Did it not work?
I thought it was okay. But you have to start out by liking Vegemite or the British equivalent Marmite. I've never known if there's a difference. I think it's just two different trade names is all. But
and of course, there's a certain element of patriotism
involved.
I'm surprised that he went with Vegemite though. Being a Brit, he ought to have gone with Marmite.
Well, no, the dinner by Heston we're talking about
is
the one that's in Melbourne.
So they did the local connection.
So yeah, if he tried to use it there, he would have been probably lynched and taken out of Australia, wouldn't he?
Probably. And of course, he probably has a Marmite recipe in London. I don't remember having dessert in that restaurant, but I don't know. So okay, the big reveal in your book, as the tease rather, is your secret ingredient chocolate fudge cake. And that's another one that I'll have to try because I'm not sure I buy it. Tell us what secret ingredient is.
So the secret ingredient is, drum roll please, it's a can of condensed cream of tomato soup.
Oh my God.
It's in a stock. Barfing into the handkerchief. But no, it really is delicious because if you think about it, sweet and sour, they are harmonious, they're symbiotic almost. And so the sweetness of the chocolate and the sugar paired with the slight tanginess of the tomato just really bumps up that chocolate fudginess. And it's an American recipe. I mean, not the recipe, but it's an American idea.
Uh-huh.
And it was Sylvia Plath. Allegedly, it was one of her favorite recipes. Not my recipe, because obviously she's sadly long gone, but it was one of her favorite cakes to have, and you must try it. I mean, it's wonderful. Just don't be a fool and buy like a herby tomato soup, otherwise you might sort of be picking bits of celery out your teeth.
I've seen the recipes for using beet and chocolate cake, and a couple at we had a dining group for a while, used mayonnaise. I thought that was pretty awful.
Mayonnaise.
Well, chocolate cake, that was the part. You do brownies?
Yeah, I have a brownie recipe, which I don't use anymore because I've got a better one. But I have an old brownie recipe that I used mayonnaise in, and they were very fudgy.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, anyway. We'll
try, but I think your book is fascinating, John.
Listeners,
and I love your comments. You are a person who loves to talk.
Let me get a word in edgewise here. In order to be able to enjoy this man's cooking to the full, you have to buy the book because you don't have a restaurant, but you do, I think, have a cooking school?
I do. I've got a cooking school in in my hometown in Lancashire, rural Lancashire. And I've had people from all over the world. I've had people from Sydney, from Hong Kong. I've got a girl in New York who is a really good friend of mine now because she came to the cookery school and we met through the cookery school and she traveled all that way. And so it's wonderful. I love teaching there because it's only at weekends. It's quite exclusive. We just do one class a week so we don't exhaust ourselves. And we have, basically, we have a party every single week with Prosecco and food.
Yes.
And it's just wonderful.
It sounds like something I'd like to do, actually.
Well, you're a credit. Well, you're a credit to Wigan to the extent that the town of Wigan deserves any kind of credit.
It's not that bad. That's
a story for another. That's a story for another day. You'll come back on because you have another book coming already. So within the year, I'm sure we'll be inviting you back. And in the meantime, John, it was a real pleasure to talk to you. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. Lovely to speak to you.
Thanks, John.
Sweetheart, I think we learned a lot today. I hope our listeners were paying attention and they learned the same amount as we did.
Yes.
And we'll be back same time, same place next week so you can learn some more.
And until then, bye-bye.